Very excited to hear from him, and so I introduce Robert D. from Visalia.
Oh my God. Cool. Testing. Hot mic. All right. So close. My name is Robert. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a proud product of Pine. Ooh, a lot of people here. My mouth just went dry. All right. So I just want to start off. I want to thank Bill Hassman for inviting me. And, you know, I want to thank anyone who came here to see me specifically. My parents are here. I want to thank them. Alfonso, thank you. you know, it means a lot to me that my parents are here tonight. You know, this is kind of I feel like this is kind of a milestone for me in my recovery, you know, just being here at this meeting, which has been around for several years. And, you know, I've been to this meeting on and off for a long time. You know, I'm a Pine retread several times, been in Pine. And, you know, I'm a chronic relapser, right? That's what, you know, me on my own power is a chronic relapser. And so that's a big part of my story. And so, you know, it means a lot to me to be, you know, on the other side here, you know, after sitting in the back for so many years. And so anyway, I guess I'll just stick with the traditional format of like how it was, what happened, and what it's like now. So, you know, I often start off by saying that I'm the only alcoholic in my family. I grew up in Hanford with my dad. My dad raised me and my brothers, and, you know, he did his absolute best with us, and we had a good upbringing. You know, I went to Catholic school, and we never went without anything that we ever needed and everything like that. But looking back, you know, even back in the old days, I was always kind of, you know, even before alcohol or anything was introduced, I was always kind of the mess up, you know, the black sheep of the bunch, I guess you could say. I was always getting calls home from teachers. I was always, you know, just real ADD kid, you know. You know, I can remember back then, it was like, I know I gave my parents a hell of a time, even back then, you know. It was like I didn't really respond to, like, normal incentives for doing good or, like, punishment for doing bad, you know. And it's just like, you know, the big book talks about when it describes the spiritual malady, right? You know, that's a trait of this disease, right? That's what I have. I have a disease of addiction, right? So there's a threefold disease. And part of it is this spiritual malady. And, you know, the big book says that we were making heavy going of life, you know, as a result of this. And, you know, I can look back and I can say that even back then that I was making heavy going of life, you know. You know, I always just kind of generally had the sense that, like, life should be easier. I shouldn't have to do all this stuff I don't want to do. And so I just didn't really care. I didn't really want to try anything. And it's just when I got in trouble, that's just the way it was, you know. And it is what it is, you know. And I was living a powerless lifestyle back then, right? And so, you know, I think it's important to talk about the spiritual malady first, because I mean that's what sets the stage for this whole thing, for alcoholism to come into place. I really think, you know, alcohol in a way was the solution, right? Alcohol became the solution for my spiritual malady, and it worked. It worked really well for a long time, right? I mean, you know, so. Anyway, so that's what happened, right? We ended up moving to Visalia. I had older brothers, and they were experimenting at probably the normal age of 16 or whatever it was when they were in high school. And, you know, when I caught wind of it, I was real curious. I really wanted to try stuff. And, you know, especially just the idea that something could make me feel better, like, or different, you know? So, so one night, my oldest brother, you know, got me high on marijuana, and, you know, that was like the most amazing experience. I don't know, like, there's certain things, like, in life, like, you hope things meet your expectations, and every now and then something will exceed your expectations. Like, marijuana far exceeded, like, anything that I had ever experienced up to that point. I mean, it was like, it freaking blew the doors off of anything I had ever done. And so, man, I was like, wow, you know, I loved it. I loved it, man. I was just like, that was my thing. Immediately, that was my thing, you know, and I knew that nobody was ever going to take that from me, you know. I was like, I'm like 12 years old, and I'm like committing to this for the rest of my life. Like, I'm a weed smoker, and so So anyway, you know, and it kind of changed my mentality in a way, right? It was like, you know, here's this thing that they're trying to keep from me, man. Society's saying it's wrong. Everybody, you know what I mean? But they're wrong. They're wrong about this, you know? And it got me like, you know, from that moment, I really sipped into a real rebelliousness, right? It was really kind of an us and them mentality, right? Them is anyone who would try to take this from me or anyone who disagrees with this, right? And us is, you know, me and my friends, my stoner friends or whatever. So anyway, you know, from that point on, I was like, I kind of regret that, you know. It was like, it was like anything my parents wanted, tried to teach me or had to say to me, I really disregard. It was like anybody that disagreed with that one thing, you know, I just completely pegged them over here and I would just disregard anything they had to say, basically. And so, you know, that wasn't too wise at that point, you know. People, you know, even if society did had it wrong or whatever, like, it put me on a whole other path, you know. But anyway, not long after, I discovered alcohol, and that was like another spiritual experience for me. You know, it was like, for me, that was about doing, man. I could go out and do. I could be a doer, right? I could go to the parties. I could be the life of the party. I wasn't shy. I wasn't scared. You know, I could go talk to the girls. I could freaking, you know, all that stuff. And I loved it, man. It was, you know, that was like my, you know, talking about the spiritual malady, that was like my solution for that, right? And so it meant a lot to me, man. It wasn't just something that I liked to do. Like, that was my solution. You know what I mean? Like, so... That was my new thing. Like, I was a drinker. And so anyway, you know, I was the type of person, I really believe that when drinking becomes the solution to the spiritual malady, it becomes the solution to everything, right? I mean, my whole life is going to be based around this one thing now. And so I would bring alcohol into any situation, and everything revolved around it, you know, and I was fine with that, you know. It didn't bother me one bit, and it was still that us and them thing, right? You know, I would drink in public, let them see me, whatever, I don't care, you know. And I was having a lot of fun, you know, and you know, I dropped out of high school, moved out of my parents a little early, which I kind of regret too, but, you know, I ended up, you know, got a job at Burger King and started drinking every day, man, living the dream. And, you know, at that time, that was pretty rad, man. I was like digging it, you know. And anyway, you know, I got good at drinking, you know. I mean, I would drink with my older brothers. I drank with some older people. You know, we were serious, man. It was like we were training for the drinking Olympics or something. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, we weren't messing around. And, you know, double shots and beer bongs and freaking shotgunning beers. And, you know, by the time I was 21, I could really drink. You know, like a man. And so anyway what's up, Dan? So anyway, where was I at? Drinking like a man, that's right. So hold on, let me pause. So, I will say around this time, right, I'm about, you know, 21, 22. I've been out of high school for a little bit, and some of my buddies are moving on. They're going to college. They're getting in serious relationships. They're kind of doing some next phase type stuff. And, you know, this is where it becomes evident that I'm starting to have a problem, right? Like, I'm trying to do things, I'm trying to sign up for school, and then I'm not able to finish a semester, right? It's like I'm too drunk to do homework, and I'm too hungover to show up, right? And then, so that just kind of fades away. And, you know, I'm trying to save money for goals and things that I want to do, and I'm just unable to save money, right? So it starts to become like, dang, there's this, you know, my intentions are over here, but yeah, my actions are over here, right? It's not really lining up. And, you know, I'm the kind of drinker, and it's not just drinking. There's a couple other substances that I lose all control, right? When I put the substance into my body, alcohol included, that's what makes me an alcoholic, right? It's not that I like to drink. It's not that I've been in trouble because of it. It's because when I put it in my body, I lose all control of how much I drink, right? So I always end up in these predicaments, right? It's like I always end up, you know, where I'm not able to pay the rent wherever I'm at, and I'm just always kind of squeezing. I'm always on the bottom because I can never save money, and it's like I'm getting kicked out of places. I'm going to jail, right? The craving for the harder stuff and for alcohol will take me into doing crimes and stuff like that. And, you know, I ended up, I started going to rehabs and jails and stuff like that. And so things got serious. You know, it started to get, you know, the consequences started stacking up. And, you know, I didn't know what to think. I just kind of thought, man, you know, when things get bad enough, I'll just walk away from it. I don't know what I thought. I thought I would outgrow it, right? I thought I would get better at it or something like that. And so, you know, it was still really early on. And, you know, I went to a rehab when I was about 19, and that was the first time I was introduced to AA, the first time I was introduced to this concept of like a disease. And I remember trying, you know, I stayed in the sober living house, and, you know, I wasn't doing the steps, I didn't really have a sponsor, and I ended up relapsing, right? I didn't really know what I was up against, I didn't know what this disease was really about. And, you know, it was kind of one of those, I'll just stay till the miracle happens things, and, you know, that's really bad advice. I just got a pension from here on out. Like, people relapse following that kind of advice. And, you know, it takes action. It takes work. I mean, there's a lot of promises in AA, and it's always preceded by action, right? The spiritual life of an alcoholic, of a recovered alcoholic, is one of action, right? I can't say that enough. And, so anyway, man, I feel like I'm already running out of time, and I definitely want to get to the 12 steps. So, but anyway, I'll just say, you know what? I'll just say that for the next, you know, for the next, let's say I was 20, 25, for the next 7 years or so, you know, it was everything I could to just, you know, to move. I was always starting over, right? It was everything I could do to just kind of run away from this set of problems. I'd start over here. I'd move with my brother in Long Beach. And then I would do real good, and then drinking would catch up to me. It was like everywhere I went, drinking catch up to me again. And I could just never get right, man. I was like, can't get right, that guy in that movie, right? So I just couldn't get right. You know, I moved to Long Beach. I moved back, and it was kind of went on a downward spiral. And you know, it was like, you know, as I'm on this kind of rotation of just staying at different people's houses all the time, you know, I'm in recovery, I'm back on the streets, I'm in recovery, I'm back on the streets, and it's like, I'm trying to make either one work. You know, at this time, I'm really trying to make either one work, and it's like, I didn't know how to do either one. I was failing on both sides of the fence, you know what I mean? I don't know if anybody's ever done that, but that was like a real kind of crappy place to be for a long time. And, you know, I'd come into recovery, and then, you know, I'd get sobered up, and I'd hear, yeah, this is a God thing or something, right? So it's like, you know, I'll go to this church over here, and I'll read this Just for Today book in the morning, and I'll do this other thing, you know, and I'll go to this meeting. And it was like I was trying to weave together this collection of things that was going to, like, keep me sober, right? And it would never work out that way, right? It was really like, it's been brought to my attention, I was really trying to self-will myself through a spiritual process, right? And it doesn't work that way, right? I'm trying to play God in my own recovery, and I'm trying to use God as like a self-help tool, right? I'm going to use Him for my purpose of what I need to use Him for, right? And so, you know, this is not a self-help program, right? This is really nothing to do with that, man. This is about taking a position. This is about being as God would have me be, right? Cozying up to God, going through 12 steps, and excuse me. To me, nothing worked until I submitted to a 12-step process, right? And so anyways, yeah, I'll just skip kind of to my 12-step process. I will say to the end, you know, it got real bleak. My world kind of shrunk up, right? I had a lot of family members that had written me off. They weren't visiting me in jail anymore. You know, and rightly so. I mean, the day I get out of jail, I'm back on the same path, right? And, you know, my world had kind of shrunken up. I didn't have so many resources. You know, my dad has a walnut ranch, and, you know, part of my story is he has, you know, I wasn't allowed in the house, right? But he had a barn out there that I was able to keep some stuff out there, and I had a bed, and it was like there were little rooms in there and everything, but like I ended up to where I would go out there sometimes when I had no place to stay, right? And I hated it at first, right? I had nowhere else to go. I would go there for a couple nights, right? Well, it got to a point where that was basically the only place left, you know what I mean? It was like right there. And you know, I had another place on the north side where I used to go, you know, and hang out and stuff like that, but that was pretty much it, man. I was just this guy that was just, you know, that you see riding a bike around town, you know, greasy clothes, you know, all picked out, you know, just you know, haven't worked in years, haven't, you know, I'm out there in a barn washing my clothes in a container. You know, I'm shoplifting all over town, breaking into cars at night, you know, taking whatever I can to the north side and to cash in for that day. And that was my life, you know. And, you know, it really, I never could have imagined that things would get that bad. And I always thought if things got that bad, I would just stop, right? I would walk away. And it never occurred to me that I just wouldn't have the power to do so when the time came. And, you know, I got to mention that, you know, part of this disease is there's the mental aspect of this disease, right? There's the physical part that I have an allergy toward, a sensitivity towards certain substances that when I put it in my body, I lose all control, right? And me, I have a reaction which is a craving beyond my mental control, right? So I might like the effect produced by alcohol, and the non-alcoholic might like the effect produced by alcohol, but in me, it also produces a craving beyond my mental control, right? So that's in the doctor's opinion in the big book, right? That's a fact of my life, right? Another part of this is I have a mental obsession, right? So at certain times, I'm mentally powerless. Even when I'm sober, at certain times, I have absolutely no willpower when it comes to picking up, right? So, you know, the best I can describe it is like there's like a switch in my head, right? And I'm not in control. When that switch gets flipped and it's go time, it's freaking, I can't unflip that switch until I get my hands on what I need to get my hands on and get to that place I need to get to, right? So that's all there is to it. I mean, I'm just completely powerless, right? And I'm just a victim of this, right? The book talks about we who have suffered alcoholic torture, and that's a big part of this, right? That's the most misunderstood part of this whole disease. And so it's no respecter of people, right? It doesn't matter what your intentions are. It didn't matter what my intentions were. I mean, you could hook me up to a lie detector test all the times that I said I would never use again, right? Never drink again. But there I go, right? I have that strange mental phenomenon that resurfaces and it continues to resurface, right? So and that was the defining fact in my life, right? It wasn't defined by how good of a person I am or by how smart I am or anything like that. It's that this strange mental feature that keeps popping up and that keeps taking me back out there, man, that I have no control over. And so I remember my last relapse. I had just gotten out of jail, and I was at Turning Point Sober Living House. And my friend Teddy had put me up there straight out of jail. I didn't have to go through the program. I was grateful for that. And I got going with my sponsor, Corby, who's my sponsor today. And we were probably in about step two. And, you know, and the mental obsession works like this, too, right? It's not just that split second right before you use. The great obsession of every alcoholic is that he can control and enjoy his drinking, right? So a lot of times, if I'm not getting on a spiritual path, even though I may start out desperate, this strange mental, this obsession comes back on that maybe it's like I have control now. Like maybe I don't need a spiritual solution, or maybe, you know, I can stay sober like a normal person, right? Like that's kind of like controlling and enjoying my drink. It's controlling and enjoying my not drinking, right? So that's what thing that takes over, right? We see it all the time in rehabs. People, by the time before they even leave the rehab, they got this again, right? They got, you know what I mean? And so that was me all the time, right? And so my last relapse, man, I was just taking my foot off the gas. I was in step two, and I can remember I was working for a guy in my home group. He was had a janitorial business, and I had just got out of the work van. He paid me like $100 cash, and had no intentions of using or drinking, right? And by the time I was crossing the street, that thought hit me, right? In the big book, it talked about suddenly the thought crossed my mind that tonight I'm not going to go stay home tonight, right? I'm going to go ride my bike to the north side. And here I am on felony probation. I'm not allowed to live with my parents or anywhere in my family's, right? I'm clinging to this, you know, this is my only place to go, right? But all those reasons are not enough to hold me in check, man. And so there I go again. I know I see some heads nodding, like there's people that can identify with this, right? That's an alcoholic trait, right? There's a room full of people here that are not stupid, that are not, you know, bad people, but have experienced this true powerlessness, right? So, So by the time I went back in that house, I grabbed my bike, I went to the north side, and that put me on a 90-day run. And within a week, I was back out to the barn, back to the same old thing. And I was like, man, here I was just over there to get away from this, and now I'm right back. It was the same thing, right? And that 90 days was hell. I mean, it was real bad. And it was really, things were starting to sink in that, like, you know, maybe this is all there is for me, you know? And maybe, you know, I'm, I just I never thought I would be there at 30, 31, and it was just like, you know, it started to sink in that, you know, how could I think this, that there's something else for me when this is where I'm at right now and where I'm always at, you know? And, you know, I started having thoughts like, man, if this is all there is, like, I don't want this, you know what I'm saying? Like, I really don't want this, and I refuse to go down this road. And so, things were coming to a head at that time. And, I think I needed that 90 days to really just kind of sit with that. And, luckily probation interceded and put me in Pine. And this time I had a desperation, I had a willingness, and I was unwavering willingness, man. I knew I had been in contact with a good home group, and it's a home group I'm in today. It's the Primary Purpose Group. We meet on Bridge Street Thursday nights at 7, and there are a bunch of big book thumpers, you know, they're all about sponsorship, all about the steps. And so I knew there was something to it, man. I knew they were just like me, and I knew that I had to get serious about this thing, and that there was no other way. I was the guy from the big book. I'm this guy, and I wasn't gonna get out of this, you know. So anyway, how much time do I have? So I hit the ground running, and you know, luckily I had a really good sponsor, Corby Giddens, and we got started, right? And the way he takes me through the big book is the same way I take other people through the big book. It's, you know, we start from the first four to the first edition, and we go page by page, line by line. And, you know, the way the big book is laid out, it's in order of the steps. I didn't even know that before, really. I started to work him out of the big book. But, you know, the first, three or four chapters up to We Agnostics is all step one. We Agnostics is step two. How it works is three and four, and so on, right? And so, you know, we didn't use any other books. I feel like the reason that there is 12-step groups, that the reason there is Pine Recoveries, that the reason there is, you know, a lot of meetings is because of the success of the early days of AA and the Big Book and what they were doing back then. If you look in the beginning forwards, they talk about having a 75% success rate, and they talk about, you know, up until the 70s, I think, for every two Big Books that was printed, one person got recovery for life. And so, you know, I don't know what mainstream AA could be a little different nowadays, right? Things have changed, and, you know, but I'm old school, man. I go straight from the big book. I truly believe that AA's the program of recovery is the 12 steps as outlined in the big book. And so anyway, that's what we did. And you know, going through step one, I really love how we go through step one. And what we do is we go through, like I said, we go through page by page, line by line, and we turn statements into questions, right? So in this way, we're not just reading it over, but we turn statements into questions, and then I have to attach my experience to it, right? So it might say something like, at certain times, our willpower becomes practically non-existent. And so we might turn that into a question, which, you know, would be, at certain times, has my willpower become practically non-existent? And so then I can't just answer yes or no questions, right? I have to attach as many experiences out of this as I can. And so it's good because it takes it to, I'm getting the description of alcoholism, and as I go through and attach all my experiences to it, it's bringing this into a gut level acceptance, right? It's a real gut level thing. And you know, I think that it's absolutely essential to have that solid foundation. I think there's a lot of people who do their best, and I think, you know, I think there's a lot of people who have the description of alcoholism in their head, and I hear people say things like, they'll say, yeah, I'm powerless, right? But then they'll talk about, but I chose to drink, you know. And I think, well, how can you say that you're powerless and that you, but then at the same time that you have a choice, right? So, you know, and I think that people can have the description of alcoholism in their head, and they can have other things in their head, and you know, but going through the, you know, turning statements into questions, and every time there's a trait of the disease that I can match with my experiences, right? It's just bringing it into a gut level, right? So, and then I'm operating on a new truth, right? I'm operating on the truth from here on out. You know, going into step two. Step two is real crucial for me. In We Agnostics and in step two, we look at what are my honest doubts and prejudice towards God. And the big book is going to direct me over and over towards looking within to find God, right? That's going to be the path. It says, as we understood him. And so, you know, it's not going to tell me to go to a specific building or a specific look in a book or anything like that, right? I'm going to find the great reality within is what it says. And so that's what a big part of this 12-step process is all about. You know, it's all about removing what's blocking me off from God from within, right? Resentments and things like that. And so, going into step two, right, I have to, I'm going to look at what are my honest doubts and prejudice, right? What things were impressed upon me as a child, or what things did I have doubts about with God? You know, I had a lot of preconceived ideas about God. I had no experience with God, right? I had lived a life apart from God, and but I had all these ideas of what God must be, and I really thought, you know, that it was a lot of negative stuff, right? And it was a lot of, you know, I don't know that I can live up to a spiritual God standard. You know, I thought that God was just ready. I thought God was just like would want to put me in a life of suffering. I thought that's what he did with people. You know, I thought that he was just going to put me in these impossible situations, and the second I flip off course, he's going to just smite me down. You know, and I mean that's what I was up against, right? And at the same time, it's like, you know, I don't want to be in too good with God, because, you know, the people that are in real good with God get martyred and things like that. You know what I mean? So it's like I just want to be just good enough, man. I just want to be just good enough. And so anyway, you know, good sponsorship. You know, we went through this and I wrote all this down on paper, right, and looked at it. And then we look at where do these ideas come from, right? They're not experiential. A lot of them I had to realize came from outside of myself, right? They came from a book. They came from a person. They came from other people, right? And so, you know, I became willing to set that aside, all those ideas aside, for a brand new experience. And in We Agnostics, it actually talks about, you know, we ask that you do not let any prejudice keep you from honestly asking you what spiritual terms mean to you, right? And that in effect, in doing this activity, this spiritual exercise, it says right there that we are in effect affecting our first conscious relation with God, right? So that's big, right? So laying aside prejudice and then defining spiritual terms, right? The spiritual terms are all over the big book. They're all the ones that are capitalized. Spirit of the universe, universal mind, father, friend, and all these things, right? And for the first time, I'm going to sit there and I'm not going to attach any mind stuff to it, any religious definitions, what the religious definition is. What in my heart do I feel like God is in these different terms, right? And so it's going to talk about, this is my first conscious relation with God. And so it proved to be, right? The results are self-evident, I'd like to say. And so is it possible, right, that if I'm setting aside prejudice and doing this exercise, that God is actually meeting me right there, and that he's actually influencing those terms, right? I mean, it's kind of crazy to think, right? But but anyway. So in step three, we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. And and I was willing to do that, right? I mean, I just, you know, came out of a barn. I just came out of, you know, a hell of a situation, man. And I'm willing to believe, man. I'm willing to believe, right? I've seen it work in Corby. I've seen it work in people. And so, you know, and what it says in the big book is the first requirement, though, right? There's a requirement for step three. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And, right, hasn't my life proved that on both sides of the tracks, right? I couldn't pull off drinking successfully. I couldn't pull off drinking like other people. I couldn't pull off being sober, right? I couldn't pull off either one, right? Any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. And so, right, and there's important considerations, right? Have I failed in making myself who I need me to be? Yes, right? Have I failed in making others who I need them to be? Right? Because it's going to talk about we were the director, right? That's going to be, you know, it talks about I was the director. I was the actor who was trying to be the director and direct the whole play, right? And so that's what, you know, how well is that working out? Are other people following my orders, right? Am I able to make women who I need them to be? Am I able to make my parents who I need them to be? No, right? Nobody, right? Am I able to make myself who I need me to be? No, I can't even make my own self who I need me to be, right? Can I provide myself with what I need to be okay, to feel okay? No, right? So I have failed utterly, right, at life. And so, so now I'm ready to make this decision, man, that hereafter in this drama of life, God will be the director, right? It's very simple, man. That's what the spiritual life is all about to me. It's about I'm not the director anymore, right? I'm going to be I'm going to let others be who they want to be, and I'm going to be who God would have me be. That's it. I mean, spiritual life could be that simple, you know? And, you know, whenever things start getting awry, start getting kind of haywire in my life, I can usually say, hey, am I being the director, right? Because when I do that, I start writing the script for everybody else, and when they're not staying put, I get a resentment or something, right? And then by the time I'm writing inventory, I'm like, yeah, I was being self-reliant again, and, you know, I kind of slipped away from it, right? So, anyway, that's the decision we're making, right? And, but it's just a decision, right? It's just a decision. We made a decision to do it, right? I can't really do it yet because I'm still blocked off from God, right? It says this decision could have little permanent effect unless followed at once by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things within myself that were blocking me off from God, right? That was something I didn't get all these other times I tried a spiritual solution, right? Maybe I had little glimpses of a spiritual experience, but they were always just kind of like, couldn't hang on to it, right? It was nothing permanent, right? Because I'm blocked off from God. What am I blocked off from? I'm blocked off from resentments, right? From resentments stem all form of spiritual sickness, it talks about, right? It says we're driven by fear, right? That was a big part of my life, right? Driven by fear, driven by what other people think of me. A lot of guilt, a lot of shame, a lot of things, right? When I was in sobriety, I could be sober and I'm being bombarded by my own mind all day long of all these different, remembering all these different things and all this cringing and all the things I've done, all the things, the people that got me, got over on me, right? I got to be free of that stuff. If I'm going to have an open channel for God to work through me, I can't be driven by all these things, right? So that's what 4 through 9 is all about. It's all about facing and being rid of the things that were blocking me off, right? That's such a crucial part of this, right? I mean, I would not be where I'm at today if I had not continued on, right? A lot of people think 1, 2, 3, and then it's like, I'll see you next time, man. I'll see you next time you come back, you know what I mean? If they're the real deal, I'm sorry, you know, and they have good intentions, right? But I mean, good intentions, you know, you can be over here with good intentions, but on the other side of 9, you know, is where you get recovered. You know, and those are the steps that's kind of separate the men from the boys. You know what I mean? That's kind of where we get into some uncomfortable stuff. So, man, it looks like I'm just about out of time, but, you know, I just want to say that, I want to say also that, you know, steps five and nine, right, those were how essential it was for me, right, as a person who was driven by fear. When I was early in recovery, I don't know if anybody can relate to this, but, like, I didn't want to be around normal people too much. I remember my first job at Jimmy John's, I was real scared of what people would think of me. I wouldn't even really conversate with people. It was like I had been living this strange lifestyle, right, and it was like I felt like if anybody shined a light on anything I had done before, there were so many, you know, sore spots in my past, and if it veered towards anything like that, it would just be a wrap, right? If anybody caught a whiff of any of that stuff, it would be over, right? And so, you know, going through the fifth step, it talks about we were living a double life, right? We were under constant fear and tension, right? And getting that, making it to the grave list, everything I thought I'd take to the grave and saying it to my sponsor, man, that was just a very, very freeing thing, right? To not be living a double life, to have that stuff out in the open, right? And then going and making amends to everybody to the best of my ability, to every wrong that I had done, right? And looking back and walking up to them in direct amends, not writing a letter and burning it or some crap like that, or living amends where I'm just going to be nice to them, but walking up to them and asking for permission to make an amends to them and laying out the harms and asking if there's anything that I'm not aware of and asking if there's anything I can do to make this situation right and letting them know that that'll never happen again and asking for forgiveness, right? That's a solid amends, and it's all in the big book, right? Accept no substitutions. That is such a powerful process. My stepmom's crying right now. The most powerful amends that I had was with her. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It melted away. She cried. I cried. It melted away years of headbutting and stuff like that. And she actually showed me kindness towards the end of my runs. She would go out to the barn and bring me food and stuff like that. And it really, man, I love that. I love that lady a lot today. And so anyway, you know, going through when you finish amends, it's like there's no more sore spots, right? I mean, I'm not that same guy anymore. And you know, you can shine a light on anything, right? There's nothing in the world I haven't told somebody. There's no wrong I haven't tried to make right. And you can shine a light on anything you want, man, because I'm not that guy no more, right? And so that's what this is all about, man. Thanks, Bill. So I gotta say, though, that, you know, if all of these steps are in place to open a channel to God and get me in a relationship with God, And all these practices are to keep that channel open. That step 12 is the lifeblood of my spiritual life today, right? We're making that third step to decision that having a new employer, right? He will take care of all my needs, right? If I keep close to him and perform his work well, he takes care of my needs, right? That's what it is to me to work with others, man, to turn around, to come into this with selfish motives and to turn around and help the next guy up. That is where all the power flows in, man. That's where I really experienced all those promises in the big book. I mean, it just came to life right there, right? And I've never turned back, right? I knew once I started working with others that it was a wrap. I was never going to go back to that old way of life. It was done, right? So, you know, and likewise, I've seen people go through all those steps and then just leave and go off to church or something like that and not work with others, man. If God has another position for me and it ain't the 12 steps, he sure wasted a lot of time getting me ready for this one. You know what I mean? So, you know, I'm going to stick with this. Anyway, you know, I think that's about it. If anybody's interested in getting involved in this 12-step process, you know, I want to invite you to my home group. We meet on Bridge Street, 7 o'clock, or we're called the Primary Purpose Group. We're Big Book Thumpers. We get into the steps. We get into sponsorship. And also, I'll be here afterwards if anybody wants to talk. Thanks for letting me share.